From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. Low-key photorealism, well-chosen non-actors, and an achingly heartfelt drama played out on the Mississippi Delta. That's Ballast, the feature film directing debut of Lance Hammer, who's here to join me. Lance, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
One of the things that struck me about seeing the film at Sundance is that it's composed almost as if it's a series of photographs. It's got a kind of photorealism. And I wonder if that was a motivating factor for you in the way you put the film together.
Everything I do really stems out of the visual first. And that's where my inspiration for narrative comes from. Inevitably, something comes out of something that's purely visual. And often that's, you know, me with a camera and taking photographs back and just really studying them and letting them sink into my cells. Audio was a very important part of this. You know, the sound of this place was very important as well.
I guess I should ask you to tell the audience what Ballast is about.
I honestly think it's about the Delta, you know, the Mississippi Delta, and it's really a document of a place. And the inspiration for the project was a challenge I had to accurately document this emotion I was feeling when I was there, and it had to do with, you know, in the wintertime in the Delta, which is a very different experience than the summer or the spring or the fall. And it was a great sense of sorrow, but it was also, you know, coupled with this ironic sense of tremendous beauty, and that related to the natural landscape itself. And, you know, it's something that I couldn't articulate at that time about 10 years ago, and I still can't articulate it. And I think that was the reason why I really wanted to make a film, because I had this kind of harebrained idea that maybe a film could communicate that emotion accurately without having to rely on words to do it. And, you know, moving imagery, the sound, the quietude of this place in the Delta, I was challenged to capture that and communicate it to somebody else. And that's how the project started. You know, ultimately, I created a narrative, but the narrative was always designed to be subservient to tone. The narrative subject deals with grieving. You know, it's really a simple story about navigating the grieving process and finding purpose again and, you know, getting on with the living process.
One of the things that it feels like it's about to me is this family in free fall, and because there's so much wide open space around them, there's really nothing for them to be anchored in.
I think, again, that has to do probably with my feeling in that place. It's the moon. It's so vast, and you're so minuscule in this, you know, God's country, and you do feel a bit like you're free-falling or that, like there's no gravity, and it's disorienting. You know, I find that, especially in the quiet, it's so beautifully quiet and disarming. I feel often like I'm floating there. It was important that this character, who, you know, is an identical twin, who loses his sibling to suicide without knowing why, you know, without having an explanation for it, it has basically become untethered from the terrestrial plane. And that's the way I always pictured it. It was an image in my head of this man floating above the surface of the Delta, you know, and the tether being severed and trying to find a way to get back to the ground.
I don't know, Lance, it's funny you say God's country, because it seems to be kind of godless in some ways. You know, there's a lot of pain and tragedy in the first half of the story.
Yeah, you know, that's that argument, isn't it? Where is God when we really need him most? I'm not particularly religious in that way, but I have a great respect of the mysteries of religion and the mystery of God. And I think I probably use that term, you know, loosely, but the power of the earth, the power of the cosmos, and you feel it that way. You feel your very minuscule presence in the scheme of things in the Delta in a way that you probably don't in the cities, you know. You lose track of that in the cities. And the Delta always reminded me that I was a flea, you know, and I could be crushed very easily.
It's The Treatment. My guest is director Lance Hammer. His feature film directing debut is Ballast, which was a big winner at Sundance this year. One of the things that's so striking about the film to me is the faces. And you must have cast these, most of your cast had not acted before or done much acting. And you must have cast them just for that look. I mean, because they're required to have long passages in front of the camera without saying anything.
Yeah, I really did cast from physical temperaments, and demeanor was everything to me. And you know, eventually we got to the point of auditioning and working on scenario to see if these people that I'd already pre-chosen based upon their physical comportment, if that would actually work. And you know, it always did, honestly. But the first point, you know, that you mentioned, that these are non-professionals. This project, if nothing else, is desire to make something very accurately about this place. And so when I was thinking first of the landscape and thinking of the environment and the context, eventually the human beings that populate this context have to be from the place as well. And, you know, I'm not from the Delta, and the Delta is a very complicated place. The history of the place is so nuanced, and there's so much complexity in especially this white and black relationship. I thought, you know, in the beginning I thought I understood it. But through the decade, as I began to really spend a lot of time there and study it, I realized how little authority I really did have to speak about anything in specificity, because it's not what you think. And you have to be born there to really speak with authority about any of these issues. So as I realized this, I realized I had to give up the voice of the film to the people I cast. I couldn't show them a script. The dialogue, the language, the idiom had to come from every individual, themselves. I would introduce an artificial scenario, and they would have to filter that through their own emotional, systems and respond as if it were really happening in their lives. I conceived of a structure, and the flesh and the tissue was actually given by the people that know the place intimately.
It's interesting you talked about, wanting to avoid artificiality and give this a sense of real flesh and blood, because the studio work you'd done before you started to make your own films was very much about creating an artificial environment, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I was an art director on studio films, and I greatly enjoy creating fantastical spaces, for superhero films, or I did at the time. But I think it's ironic because every art director's real goal is to create something that's ultimately completely believable, and the irony is that you just can find that and not do any work, and it's perfect. So, what we did, it was very important that all the locations were found and we couldn't touch them. They were sacred in that way.
It's funny because one of the things that really struck me about the film is when they're indoors, there's a sense of ceilings. Ceilings are rarely a part of films just because when you're building a space, you want to be able to use the lights in the way that you can.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And we didn't have lights. I think, the actors were free to do whatever they wanted at any time. And all through this long rehearsal process, we explored every possibility. And as a result, we had to be handheld because Lal Crawley, who shot the film, he had to anticipate what the actors were doing and kind of dance with them and follow. We didn't have lights either because they would get in the way. If the actors wanted to go left instead of right, we had to be able to pan with them and move with them. And if there was a lighting set up there, it would kill the scene. So I think as a result of that freedom that we created, 360-degree fully valid field of view, the ceiling became valid. And Mike Smith is a very large man. He's 6'3".
And we're talking about Lawrence, who's the surviving twin brother who has to help work out this family dynamic that's missing in the film. And just the sense of how big he is because of those ceilings when he's inside.
Yeah.
You can't really tell how big actors are often in films because the physical spaces that are built for them are built to maximize what the camera can do rather than real living spaces. And I just really had that sense and balance of being in a place where people actually lived and conducted their lives and had to get around the confines of those spaces.
Yeah, because they were real places. They were the real thing. It was very important to find existing houses and just, we moved some furniture in from other places that existed. So that was the next best solution. Every other location in the film was exactly as it was, we found it. As an art director, I just want to go that one extra yard, which is to abandon artificiality altogether and just accept reality as it is and do no work. And so doing, you have perfection, and you don't have a job, though.
It's the treatment. The job I have is interviewing director Lance Hammer. His feature film debut as director is Ballast, a prize winner at this year's Sundance Film Festival. There's a car sequence between Marley, who's the single mother of James. One of the reasons that it really works is you get that sense of how small the car is and how there's nowhere to go when they're trying to get around this car of drug dealers who are threatening her young son. And that makes it really terrifying. And without use of music or cross-cutting or any of the conventional tricks of conveying suspense when there are two cars on the road, you did something I thought was kind of unusual.
Yeah, just making the camera stay put. it's trapped. The Delta is this wide-open lunar landscape in the winter. It's emptiness. There's fallow fields. There's no leaves on the trees.
And not much sun.
So you're constantly in a vehicle moving through space. The Delta experience is about driving. And you get in these little tiny vehicles and you're trapped, you know. But it's an important part of the spatial experience, I think, is to the sense of being in this tremendous openness but being stuck in something very small. That's the whole issue with the cars. I really wanted to use a lot of transportation, a lot of moving through space in a vehicle. And then when they're in the car in that scene you're mentioning, being almost attacked, there's nowhere to go.
I guess I'm fascinated, too, but you talked about sound, because one of the things, there's a scene that kind of precedes that car sequence that almost leads up to it. So James fires a gun, and the sound of the gun isn't that kind of cannon fire sound we're used to in movies, but there's that pop that guns almost really sound like, and just the equating of that pop with a real sense of danger and also the sense of how far that bullet has to travel is a really interesting sequence, too. It really does feel like it's almost in outer space where physical laws don't actually apply.
It was very important with the sound. All the sound had to be the real thing. Like, we couldn't fake anything. So we took a gun in that field. You know, we didn't want it to go. We had to actually record it in the place to get the reverb of the place. Shot it and recorded it, and that was it. And it was just so modest.
Dinky. It's a dinky little sound. So the idea is somebody recording from this pop is really kind of both funny and scary.
Yeah. I mean, because I think most people have heard a gun in reality go off, and it's much more terrifying than the, you know, multi-tracked cannon fire that you hear in Hollywood.
Yeah, and there's basically no music in the movie.
Yeah, and it stemmed from a desire to accurately convey the sensation of this place. And the sound of it is so important to my experience, and this beautiful quiet. But in the quiet, it's actually very complex. You have just a lot of muted sounds, but many of them. You have the distant sounds of the trucks reverberating off these hardwood trees. It's a very different sound than it is in the summer, because there's leaves on the trees and it makes a different sound. And there's no insects. There's, you know, the sound of the snow geese and way off in the distance. And so it's so fragile. To put music on that would have completely contaminated it. It would have destroyed that fragility, and it would have defeated the purpose.
But what you're also getting so often in the film, and I wonder how key this was to you, is the sound of movement. I mean, the sound of feet either hitting a floor or hitting that dead grass. Or one of the things that really struck me is when Lawrence is going to get his dog Juno back, and you can hear the dog's nails hitting the surface of that floor inside.
Yeah, I like those things. I like those very subtle sounds when there's nothing else around, because that's, you know, that's what it's like there. It's so peaceful. It's so peaceful. And so the smallest sounds mean a lot. You know, the sound of nails on a hardwood floor takes on gargantuan meaning when in the city you'd lose it. I'm interested in sound. Like, I'm interested in the things that happen off camera. I'm interested in when two people are talking to each other, it's much better to focus the gaze of the camera on the person listening. If you really want to know what's happening, you know, this comes from Godard, you know. If you really want to understand a scene and really want to understand what somebody's saying, study the person that's listening. And, you know, I think that applies to sound as well. Making a viewer search the frame or look for meaning in a place they're not expecting it, and it really causes you to engage them that way, I think. Try a little bit harder.
We'll take a break. My guest is director Lance Hammer. His feature film debut as director is Ballast, which is in theaters now. More to come. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com. I'm talking to Lance Hammer, the director, the first time feature film director of Ballast, which had a great run at Sundance, is now playing in feature film theaters around the country. I guess one of the things you did, though, was you had a deal for release of the film, and you decided to, cancel that deal and release the film yourself. Where did that come from?
it wasn't a deal. It was we were going down the path towards a deal, and at Sundance you start talking about a deal and you make kind of a commitment to each other to do this, and then you have to really work out the details, and the devil's in the details, you know. I was with IFC, and they're a company I really respect. Their curatorial taste is like impeccable. But the bottom line is, you know, there's no money in independent film right now. And the marketplace is really falling apart, as I think a lot of people know. And in order for a company like IFC or, you know, Sony or somebody to survive, they can't offer the kind of money they used to in the form of an advance, or else they will go out of business. And they can't, you know, they can't do that. So, you know, this year at Sundance, I think, marked a kind of a sea change. And we were offered several, you know, deals with great companies, but they were all basically the same financially. And it's effectively free, you know. I effectively had to give up my film for free after spending 5 years of my life on it, 10 years, actually, in the Delta. And in so doing, you have to give up creative control or, you know, control of the copyright for 20 years. And I just didn't see the logic in that. It just seemed completely illogical to do all this work and then at the end say, here it is, you can have it for free and you can have all control over it. So I decided not to. It was very important for me to first determine whether it was possible to take a film to the marketplace independently. And, you know, essentially what I did was I researched for many months, speaking to everybody I knew, and decided I could put together a team of people that could do as good of a job taking the film to market as any one of these distributors could, because, you know, they're very small teams that actually take a film to market. And we decided to take a risk and put together our own team.
I just found myself wondering, because you do have a film, an art film with primarily an African-American cast. And I'm sure one way or another you heard, or in de facto ways heard, that that limits the kind of audience you'll get.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear that everywhere, you know, and whether there's truth in that or not, it doesn't really matter to me, because one of the great liberating things about having somebody offer you nothing is that you don't have to make anything to prove yourself. There's nothing to prove. I don't have to make any money and to be in exactly the same position I would have been in going through a major distribution company. So I'm free to do what I want. We can take it to the South and Atlanta and Jackson and New Orleans and start going into the Southern universities. It's most important to present the project to the subjects, you know, like this is a film about the South. It should be presented in the South. And that's what we're doing, you know. I don't care whether it's profitable or not. There's no place in art for the market. Money has no place in it, in my opinion. Life is very short. And if you want to do something that's meaningful in your life as an artist, you can't go down that road. And there's consequences to that, you know.
One of the reasons I find the film fascinating, and one of the things I'm sure might deter major distributors, is that the film is like a blues song made by Robert Bresson.
Yeah, well, I like that. I like that analogy. Robert Bresson is the one major influence in my process.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's I carried notes from the cinematographer in my pocket on the set just mainly for inspiration and guidance and like just to make sure I keep the compass pointed in the right direction. The blues is a very important form of music to me, and I'm a musician, and this is the kind of film I was after. Although, you know, it's kind of a white blues in a way, I guess, because in my opinion, to really play the blues, you really have to be from the Delta, and you have to be black, and it's specifically that experience. You can get close, but you can't quite hit it, you know, unless you are truly of that place.
It's The Tree Room. My guest is director Lance Hammer. His feature film debut as director is Ballast. Well, the reason I said blues, too, because it's a Delta and there's also people at a crossroads, which is so much a part of what the blues are.
Yeah. I had a lot to do with authoring this film, but who had a lot to do with authoring this film as well is the actors, and that was purposeful, you know. So if you're feeling something authentic that's resonating in the way that blues does, I would venture to say that's coming from the actors themselves in the choice of their language and mostly in their physical expression when they're not saying anything and we're just documenting. We're just standing there and observing and recording. That's entirely owned by the actors.
It struck me that way just because I have family in Hattiesburg.
Uh-huh.
It's a very different place in the spring versus the winter.
Yeah.
But the one thing you find yourself doing is you see lots of people either driving alone or walking alone. And there's that kind of compact you have to make with being alone.
Mm.
That's also a part of the film and part of the blues as well, too, for me. And that seems to be at least reflect in the kind of character studies you get from your actors.
Yeah, it's very much about a solitary experience. Probably it resonates most closely with me with the boy, Jemiron Ross, who plays James. That character is understanding his world by existing in it in a solitary way and being contemplative and being in nature and being with animals and trying to make sense of his world by being out in that god or godless country by himself. And there's something about being in space alone without social pressures, you know, having to keep up a conversation with somebody else. And your mind truly can go to a place that can contemplate death. And you know, ultimately, it's all about death. You know, it's about mortality, I think. And this film is about that. It's about reconciling the fact that we're here for a very short period of time. And I think that's a solitary experience. You go to the grave alone. You pass through alone, you know.
Each of these characters is kind of at a crossroads. I mean, we can say that James is there just because he kind of aspires to this sort of urban existence or probably some urban existence that he's seen popularized in the media. But given where he's living, he can't really live it. His mother is at this kind of transitional crossroads between the life she's left behind and what she wants. And Lawrence, who is an uncle, but a reminder of the father figure that's no longer in their lives, is in this crossroad too, both in business terms and in familial terms as well. And those are all kind of things. And that silence just feels to me like that solid 4/4 of the blues, you know?
Yeah, you know, I never thought about it in terms of crossroads, but I think you're exactly right. And the crossroads physically are that those two houses, like
absolutely,
and they collide. Like you can collide at intersections are dangerous places, aren't they? There's traffic fatality potential at this intersection for sure, and it's about being stuck in a place together and not being able to proceed because you know you both want the right of way. I guess I don't know. I think this crossroads idea, you're really onto something that I completely didn't see, but it's there. You're right. You're right.
Well, yeah, we should get this recorded. I was right for once. And you shot in widescreen. Was it Super 16 you used?
No, it was Super 35.
Because there's a kind of color resonance you get in those blues that aren't too sharp but are very moody that you get in film that you don't get in digital.
I'm a big fan of digital. I won't ever use it, but I'm a big fan of it.
Why won't you use it?
Because I'm very polarized in this way, I think, where I have such admiration and I spend so much of my time thinking about innovation and technological innovation, yet I'm so romantic and so traditionalist in this other side of me. And film just looks a lot better still. And we're used to that language, like the particular grain structure, the compression, the softness, the great detail or gradations within shadow and blacks.
Well, that's something you really get in film, isn't it, finally? I mean, when you print it, you get blacks that you can't really get yet with digital. This kind of gradation you get in black because digital blacks are basically almost either India ink black or they're just a kind of grayish. And what you do, and especially in those rooms where the sun really isn't and there's not a lot of light, you really use the shadows beautifully.
Yeah, and you know, it was very important. Since we used only available light, I really wanted a lot of darkness, and we close all the shades. In order to be safe, to make sure we were recording image on the negative when the light meters were saying there was nothing there was to shoot it on film because you knew you're going to have something there. And a film about darkness, you really have to shoot it on film, in my opinion. You know, it's going to change. The technologies are rapidly evolving and the public's ability to embrace a new visual language that's informed by the aesthetic of digital and the kind of crispness and the perfection of it, that's on its way. But it's not completely here yet, so I'm going to be a little romantic, I think, for a while.
It's the Treatment. My guest is director Lance Hammer. His directorial debut, in feature terms, is the new film, which is getting a release now, Ballast. I guess one of the things I find myself wondering about the film, though, is if there were photographic models for you, if there were photographers or filmmakers that you'd studied. I mean, besides Bresson, maybe even the Dardenne brothers, I suspect.
Yeah, the Dardenne brothers, I'm a very big fan of them. I think there's been a lot of discussion around this film about the influence of the Dardennes. And in my opinion, what's happened here, because I wasn't thinking of them consciously, but I was thinking consciously of Bresson. And I know that the Dardennes think very consciously of Bresson. So we're both kind of motivated and directed by the same star. So I think it's natural that there's going to be some overlap. But Also, you know, I don't know, there aren't that many American filmmakers that use that kind of vocabulary that's very common in Europe. Like, you know, you could just as easily compare this to, let's say, Christian Mungiu's 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days. There's no musical score. It's, you know, handheld camera, an attempt to be extremely realist. And, you know, they didn't compare that film to the Dardenne brothers because it's Romanian, I think. I don't know. I'm a little sensitive to that because I think it's an easy – people are not really doing the homework on this. But having said that, Le Fils by the Dardennes, I think, is a piece of cinematic perfection. It's a perfect film. There's nothing that matches that in my mind. Rosetta's pretty close.
Yeah, I guess I thought I did say Bresson for me was particularly, but I also wondered because of the look and because of those big frames, if there were photographers, because it felt to me like there were as many photographic points of inspiration as there were filmic.
Yeah, you know, let's see. I think William Eggleston was, he's a Mississippi, I think he was born in Sunflower County. We definitely referenced him in our discussions, Lowell Crawley and I.
And Lowell Crawley's your cinematographer.
Yeah. And so, you know, he was operating the camera. He was having to respond to what an actor was doing and changing in a scene, and then also trying to be aware of the context, because we discussed this so extensively that the context that the characters exist within is as important as the characters, or more even. Maybe that's the wrong thing to say, but that's the truth. We were constantly thinking of composition. We'd stay in the spaces forever and just study every aspect of them and then go outside and just sit there and watch. Lowell turned me on to a photographer by the name of Todd Heido. You know, he does these very long exposure shots of a mercury vapor lamp and a house in the snow, you know. And they're, I don't know, an hour exposure or something, or 15 minutes. And so there's a couple shots in the film where we did that, where we just locked off the camera on a tripod, which was the anomaly for the film. And, and you know, we had these very long exposures for a motion picture camera, like a second, you know, one frame per second or something like that. And the lights would burn in that way. You know, we didn't do that very much. And to be fair to Todd, you know, Todd, if you're out there, thank you for that. Thanks, Lowell, for turning me on to those beautiful images. So much of this is Lowell's film, you know. It was the actors, it was myself, and it was Lowell. And Sam Watson, who did the sound, we were an inseparable unit, all of us. And we really went with our own gut. And the landscape speaks to you. It really does. It in a way, when you get into the rhythm of the film, it starts telling you what it wants to do. And you just have to be like an antenna and be receptive to it, you know, like a dowsing wand, I guess. The landscape and the actors were telling us what needed to happen. And we were just responding.
Well, that's probably a great point to end on. Lance, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure to be here.
My guest is Lance Hammer. His directorial debut, his feature film debut, is the film Ballast, which is playing in theaters now. Our recording engineer, KCRW in Santa Monica, is Mario Diaz, with assistance from Lashik Wojcik at Carnegie Recording Studios. Bob Carlson is the editor. Gemma Dempsey is the producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.